This is a story about a relationship, with mutual admiration and emulation, hopes raised and dashed, with cooperation and competition, with idealism, betrayal, disillusionment, and yet with neither side ever quite being able to, or wanting to, quit the thing. This is a story about America and China, Meghua and Zhonghua, or, in the literal translation from the Chinese, the beautiful country and the Middle Kingdom. It's a story that goes right back to the founding of the United States and continues to this moment, with each side looking to the other, influencing the other, sometimes resenting or even fearing the other. It's one of the most important and impactful relationships ever, and understanding how it has shaped each country's sense of itself and its place in the world just might help us think about how it could shape the future. This is Whose Century Is It?, a podcast about ideas, trends, and twists shaping the 21st century. I'm Mary Kay Magstead. And of course, this topic is close to my heart. I'm not only an appreciative student of history, I also lived in China as a foreign correspondent for 15 years. A colleague I knew there, in fact, first met on the streets of Saigon in Vietnam in 1989 after he got kicked out of China following the Tiananmen Square crackdown, has just written a really engaging book on how Americans and Chinese have been in and out of each other's thoughts and lives and countries and trajectories for 250 years. It's called The Beautiful Country in the Middle Kingdom, and I sat down with its author, former Washington Post Beijing bureau chief and fluent Chinese speaker John Pomfret, to talk about some of the colorful characters, unexpected twists, and ongoing undercurrents in the U.S.-China relationship. This is not only really interesting stuff, it's also really important stuff, especially as Donald Trump enters the Oval Office with his own ideas of what the U.S.-China relationship is and should be. So, I'm letting this episode run longer than most, but here's a little cheat sheet so you can listen a bit at a time if you don't have time to listen to it all in one go. The first third is about how and why America's founding fathers admired China and why China admired the founding fathers. It's about how America's trading with China helped turbocharge the early American economy, and about how Americans first embraced and then resented Chinese immigrants and their fierce work ethic in the 19th century. The second third is about what happened in the early 20th century, after the last emperor lost his throne in China and a new democracy was born, only to give way first to autocracy and then to the rise of communism, and how, when it comes to how America and Americans responded along the way, it didn't always go as you'd think. The last third is on modern China, China since Mao, since the Tiananmen crackdown, China as a growing economy and rising global power, and what's at stake and what's in play as Donald Trump challenges the status quo. So here we go. Enjoy.
So let's just start with actually talking about doing this kind of history of China. So Chinese Lessons was one of my favorite books by a journalist written recently on China. It was a very personal and poignant history about your own time as a student in Nanjing in the early 80s, when the United States was very interested in China. There was this hopeful, optimistic feeling, both from the U.S. and from China, about what the future of relations would be, what the future of China would be. And now you've turned to a different way of looking at history. What got you interested in doing this project?
I've lived China, and I've lived U.S.-China. I'm sort of a living example of one of the beneficiaries of the relationship, right? I went there when I was 21 in 1980, one of the first groups of American students to go there, studied there for 2 years during this incredibly hopeful time, this time of intense mutual curiosity, almost obsession and enchantment. And then went back to the States, became a journalist, went back to China, covered the Tiananmen Square crackdown, was expelled from China, had my little China dream smashed, but then got back into China in 1996 and covered China and basically had this ringside seat on a country as it became an economic power. And then left China, wrote Chinese Lessons, left China, and came back to D.C. where I was covering U.S.-China relations. And along the way of this whole process of living in China, meeting my wife there, engaging with Chinese diplomats, businessmen, engaging with Americans who engaged with China, I bumped into these ghosts, which, like an example, would be the incredible American belief that the Chinese want to become like us, or the Chinese reliance on the United States to save China's bacon in the international arena, whether it be from the Brits or from the Japanese or from the Russians, the Soviets. I became really interested in where these ideas came from. And to get to some of the roots of our relationship was what put me on this journey.
And going back right to the beginning of U.S. history, the founding fathers admired much about China. And then Chinese, different generations of Chinese admired the founding fathers.
Right. There's been a mutual admiration. I mean, the American founding fathers, Ben Franklin, really liked the Chinese. He was really interested in how the Chinese conducted their censuses. He wanted to know how the Chinese heated their homes.
He was interested in their prisons.
Right.
What about their prisons interested him?
Well, he believed that the Chinese were involved in the betterment of men. He believed that the Chinese conducted a humanist tradition that believed that men could improve themselves. And part of Confucian philosophy is that men can improve themselves, although the Chinese prisons were not necessarily sort of the be-all and end-all of self-improvement.
Then or now.
Exactly. And then on the other side, on the Chinese side, very early on, in the 1840s and 1820s also, the Chinese began to look at the West, but specifically after the 1840s, after 1842, when the Chinese lost the Opium War to the British, the Chinese became curious about the Western barbarians because they needed to know how to beat them. They wanted basically to know how to confront them. And as a series of scholars were tasked by the Qing court to study the Western barbarians, they developed, almost to a man, a fascination with George Washington. And that fascination has continued up until Mao Zedong, at least. Mao was quite taken by George Washington. And for several reasons, of course. One, Washington beat the British, and so immediately the Chinese liked him. Two, his cannot tell a lie type of mythology really attracted the Chinese because so many of their mandarins at the time were completely corrupt. And three, Washington, in his unwillingness, one, to become an emperor, and two, to stay on as president, and he wanted to retire to Mount Vernon, really struck the Chinese as something deeply unusual, considering the Chinese emperors basically stayed on the Dragon Throne until they died. And for these three reasons, the Chinese wrote about him with great passion and appreciation and respect.
So also at the very beginning of the United States, the birth of the nation, some of the national fortune came from trading with China.
The founding fortunes in New England were made in the China trade. And that money, and we're talking the Astors, the Forbeses, the Greens, the Lowes, all these prominent American families, who then turned and took their profits from the China trade and invested it into what became the foundation of American manufacturing, which were the textile firms in New England, that touched off this massive industrial revolution in the United States. I mean, that money played a direct role in the creation of America as the first great 18th century, 19th century factory of the world.
Yeah, you have some great stories about specific Americans who did business in China and also the people with whom they did business. There was a merchant from Guangzhou, Wu Bingjian, Hao Kua, who really trusted and admired Americans in particular, and in contrast to Europeans who were doing business in China.
Right. Well, at the time in Guangzhou, so we're talking, this is the early 1800s, the British were the big dog. And the British East India Company, which is this massive monopolistic trading firm, kind of like the Walmart of the day, because they bought so much, they could afford to force the Chinese to sell tea at a lower price per caddy. Whereas the Americans, of course, bought less, so that Hao Kua could actually make a bigger profit doing business with them. Also, the East India Company came and they often bartered with the Chinese. They bartered a lot of cloth from English textile mills, but also they were very early into running opium. And the Chinese actually smoked a lot of it. And so the barter traffic made it difficult for the Chinese to monetize the profits they got from the East Indian Company. Whereas the Americans very early on were trying to bring products to China and selling products. First, they brought ginseng because there's a type of ginseng that grows in the United States. They brought sandalwood. They bought sea otter pelts. They bought seal pelts. But ultimately, Americans really brought a lot of silver. And silver was cash in China. And so immediately, the Chinese traders were very positive about doing business with the United States. And Hao Kuo was the lead trader at the time in Guangzhou. He was probably the richest man in the world. And the Americans had very close relations with him, specifically the Cushing family and also the Forbes family. The Forbes family continues to have an influence in America today because our Secretary of State under Barack Obama is named John Forbes Kerry. It's the same family that made huge profits in the China trade. And so Hao Kuo worked closely with the Americans.
So not just him, but also others in China got the impression that Americans were pure of heart and loyal to China. Why did they get that impression? What were Americans doing in China that set them apart from other foreigners that Chinese were dealing with then?
So if you look at how Anglo-Americans settled the United States, the continental United States, they had an army at their back, so they could afford to push very aggressively against Native Americans. But when the Americans went to China, they didn't have a massive navy. There was a very small East Indian squadron, but it was tiny compared to what the Brits had. Nor did they have diplomatic representation. Basically, the Americans were put in a position of having to beg, borrow, and steal. When they traveled to China, they were completely reliant on the kindness of strangers. They docked at French ports, they docked at British ports, and then they came to China with no power, and so they had to accommodate Chinese interests. In addition, the United States was founded on the principle that having colonies was a bad idea. And the Chinese learned very quickly that that was one of the founding ideologies of the United States. And they liked that because specifically after the 1840s, when the British and the French and other countries began to hive off spheres of influence in China, the Americans generally opposed that. And the Chinese looked to the United States from that perspective as a potential bulwark against European and then ultimately Japanese imperialism.
So as I was reading your book, it seemed like there had been waves, certainly in the 19th century and going well into the 20th, of many Chinese looking to the United States with admiration, with hope that the United States would help China possibly become a bit more like the United States. And in the United States, there were people who looked to China and thought, we can work with China and somehow together we can be greater than we would be separately on our own. One of these people was Anson Burlingame, who said, "The imagination kindles at the future which may be and which will be if you will be fair and just to China." And he actually, interestingly, you describe how he negotiated agreements with Europeans that were beneficial to China without consulting the Chinese. So on the one hand, that's nice, but on the other hand, a little, you know, patronizing in an odd way.
So Anson Burlingame was the first U.S. minister to China based in Beijing. And he traveled there in the 1860s as the Civil War erupted in the United States. He was a representative, obviously, of the State Department and of William Seward, who was Lincoln's Secretary of State. And if Seward hadn't had to deal with a civil war, he would have been probably one of the great American Secretary of States looking at Asia. Okay, he was responsible for what is known as Seward's Folly, which is the purchase of Alaska from the Russians. But he was also a real advocate for American move to the Pacific coast and engagement with China and with Asia as a great trading nation. And Burlingame was very much cut from that same cloth. Burlingame believed in what he called the cooperative policy, which was an end to gunboat diplomacy with China and much more patience with the Chinese. And part of a strain of American ideas about China, more accepting of China the way it is and not hoping to transform China immediately into a carbon copy of the United States. This belief, a very optimistic belief that with time, China is going to develop more and more like us, but we need to give China time and to back off on our pressure of China. And he was very convincing. He convinced the British at the time to drop their more aggressive policies to China. And the Chinese liked him so much, they asked him to lead their first great delegation to Western nations, which arrived in the United States and then went from America to Europe and then on to St. Petersburg in Russia, where he got a cold and was dead in 2 weeks. which was a great tragedy, of course, for U.S.-China relations and also for the course of Qing Dynasty diplomacy.
So that was mid-century. And then going forward just a couple of decades, the U.S. economy kind of hit the skids and attitudes toward China really started to shift.
Right. So after the Civil War, there was a huge demobilization, naturally, of the fighting men, both on the South and the North, and many of them came to California. And by 1873, the economy was in a deep recession, actually probably a depression. And the Transcontinental Railroad had already been built. And so the industries and factories of California could not compete with the products from the East Coast because it was just a couple days away from the East Coast markets now. Previously, it had been several months. And so millions of people were out of work. And many of them were Irish and Welsh, a lot of miners. And they went after the Chinese because the Chinese were an important percentage of the population. They were about
a third, right?
In some places, a third along
in
the whole
Montana,
west. In Montana,
Idaho.
Around Montana, Idaho, along the whole western United States, they were a tenth of the population. But a significantly higher percentage of the working men population because the Chinese were basically all men. Very few Chinese women were in the United States at the time. So the Irish and the Welsh and other American working men, mostly Anglos, went after the Chinese with a lot of violence. The California Working Men's Party was founded on the principle that, as they said, the Chinese must go, of kicking the Chinese out of the United States. Whereas just a few years ago, in 1868, China and the United States had concluded a treaty that opened the doors to bring more Chinese laborers to America. Now, by 1882, 1883, the United States actually passed legislation called the Anti-Chinese Exclusion Act, which banned Chinese laborers from ever coming to the United States. In fact, the whole architecture of the Immigration and Customs Authorities was created to keep Chinese out of the United States, not to keep Mexicans, but to keep Chinese out of the United States.
Right. And there were calls at one point for a wall to be built to keep Chinese out who were coming. There were like 20,000 who came up through Mexico. Yeah.
Right. So the build a wall idea is not a new one, basically. Like many of the pronouncements in American politics vis-a-vis the Chinese or vis-a-vis immigrants, there's nothing new here.
Right. And another echo in the past of what has been proposed now, the Geary Act, right? So this was requiring all Chinese to register to get an internal passport in the country. But in a very, I think, personally, admirably Chinese way, they're like, yeah, screw that. So like 5,000 out of 110,000 actually registered.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've discovered in doing the book is that I knew about the anti-Chinese legislation, I knew about the anti-Chinese racism and the pogroms and the lynchings of Chinese, but I didn't know that much about how the Chinese countered this kind of treatment. Because often in the States, the portrait of the Chinese has been, in terms of the Chinese American, has been written as a victim. But the reality is a lot more complex. And the Chinese actually fought these ordinances and these laws very aggressively. And they used some of the best lawyers in the United States because the Chinese Benevolent Association, which was a collection of merchants, Chinese merchants in America, had a very good collection system where they took money from Chinese laborers sort of as a tax. And then they had large pots of money and they used that to afford some of the best lawyers in the country. And so they challenged a lot of these ordinances. And from my perspective, it's fascinating that Chinese cases, several of which went actually up to the Supreme Court, and they won cases there. And those cases ended up being the judicial foundation of the cases in the 1950s that attacked the separate but equal system for black children in the South. These connections between the Chinese lobbying for their civil rights in the United States and further lobbying for civil rights for all Americans, I think, was one of my happy discoveries in the book.
Yeah. And as one example, talk about the case of Wong Kim Ark.
So Wong Kim Ark was born in the United States and he left America with his family to go to China. And he came back once and then he left again and he came back a second time. And when he came back a second time into the port of San Francisco, a famed San Francisco immigration officer, infamous, who was known for writing poems to the lawyers for Chinese immigrants, boasting about how he was rousting these people out of the country. This guy decided that Wong Kim Ark should not be allowed back into America, and that even though he was born on American soil, he was actually not an American because the culture of his family was so different that how could this Chinese guy be an American? And Wang Kemark got very good legal representation through the Chinese Benevolence Association, and they took the Americans to court, and they won in the Supreme Court. And that was the case that settled for all time the question of, if you were born in America, are you an American? And it was settled because of a Chinese citizen of the United States.
Moving into the early 20th century, so the age of dynasties in China was coming to an end. And Sun Yat-sen, the founder of the Republic of China, was looking to the United States as an inspiration. And the U.S. wasn't entirely sure how to deal with him. I mean, at first it was like, yeah, this is great. But then there was some pushback from a guy named Goodenough who said, yeah, you know, I think this constitution that you guys have come up with in China. So Sun Yat-sen had been pushed out of power, and now it was Yuan Shikai who was a general, and he wanted to be an autocrat. And Goodenough came in and said, yeah, we think that China's not ready for democracy. It's best to have an authoritarian leader. So let's just water down your constitution. I mean, it's kind of astounding that an American played this role.
So I think there's always been an essential American tension in how our, if you will, elites have looked at China. The tension is between the desire to have an Americanized China and also the desire to have a strong and stable China. And sometimes those ideas run together, and sometimes they run contrary to each other. But it's two very powerful strains in how we've looked at China, both strong and stable and or Americanized. And by Americanized, I mean Christian or democratic or capitalist. And Sun Yat-sen comes into the scene. So here's this guy. He's an immigrant from China. He is schooled and spends his formative years in Hawaii. He becomes Christian. He learns a great deal about the American system. He goes to medical school, and he embraces what he believes to be the necessity of a violent revolution. He takes huge amounts of inspiration from the United States because it threw off the British rule. He believes that the Han Chinese should throw off the Manchu rule because the Manchus were the ruling dynasty. And so he pulls a lot of ideas, and he also was deeply influenced by Abraham Lincoln's ideas, and he pushes this idea of a radical revolution in China. In 1911, this revolution happens. And he, for a while, is the provincial president. But Sun Yat-sen didn't control the gun. And Yuan Shikai, who was an autocrat based in Beijing, did control the gun. And so Yuan Shikai basically pushes Sun Yat-sen out of the presidency and takes over the country. And he's supported strongly by American diplomats in Beijing, who looked at Sun Yat-sen and said, yeah, he might be American-influenced, but the China that he's going to run is going to be chaotic. We won't be able to deal with it. It's going to be a mess. The Chinese are too backward to actually enjoy the fruits of American democracy. And remember, this is a time in the United States when women couldn't vote, most blacks couldn't vote. You know, it was a time where democracy in America was viewed by the white ruling class as being something that belonged only to the white ruling class, right? And so these men then looked at China and said, well, what, these Asians, I mean, they're even more backward than our American poor. They shouldn't be allowed to vote. That view that China needed to be stable first was a view that people like Frank Goodenough embraced. And so Goodenough came to China. He was a leading American political scientist, recommended by Charles Eliot, who was at the time the president of Harvard University, to basically help Yuan Shikai write a constitution in China that would give Yuan Shikai, who was then the president of the country, overweening power over everything, and to turn China's legislature into basically a rubber stamp organ. And interestingly enough, at the time, of course, Chinese liberals were aware that this was happening. And as Hu Shi, who was at the time Chinese leading liberal, said, basically, if you want to learn how to speak English, the way to do it is to speak English. If you want to learn about how to be a democracy, the way to do it is to practice your democracy. And so why are we being denied this by our leaders? That was, from my perspective, an interesting counter to the Goodenough theory that China needed a one-party state.
So another example of realpolitik, and this takes us to the end of World War I, when, again, Chinese were looking with hope to the United States, to Woodrow Wilson. He said, we're going to have permanent peace. We're going to find a way to all come to an agreement about where borders should be, and we'll agree not to fight each other anymore. And the Chinese are like, great, wow, that's awesome. Even Confucius didn't come up with that idea. And then they were disappointed again.
So The Americans were really important in getting China to enter World War I. The Japanese entered World War I on the side of the Allies, the side of the United States and France, and China did as well. The Japanese gave some troops. Actually, they fought the Germans in Shandong, and they took Shandong province away from the Germans during World War I. And the Chinese, instead of contributing troops, they sent hundreds of thousands of laborers to dig trenches in Europe to free the Europeans, Brits, and French to fight. And at the end of the war, the Chinese, being on the winner's side, expected that they were going to get some spoils. And Wilson's 14-point speech was a huge hit in China. The Chinese basically had pro-Wilson demonstrations. Mao Zedong, who was a young rabble-rouser in Hunan province, wrote essays praising Wilson. Chen Duxiu, the founder of the Chinese Communist Party, called Wilson the number one great man in the world. So the Chinese were overwhelmingly positive about Wilson's speeches and his promises that there would be no more secret treaties, that nations would be able to be equal, big or small, that there would be a permanent peace, as you said. And so we entered the 1919 Versailles Peace Conference, and the Chinese entered the conference basically wanting to get rid of all the unequal treaties, wanting very much to get Shandong back, because Shandong being one of the cradles of Chinese civilization, the birthplace of Confucius, etc. So they're looking for the peace conference to actually carry out these ideas of Woodrow Wilson. And they get kicked in the face because of secret deals that the British and the French had made with the Japanese over Shandong. Wilson was put in a position where he couldn't push for Shandong to be returned to the Chinese. And in other areas, the Chinese didn't get what they want. And so basically, the Chinese become the only country that doesn't sign the 1919 peace agreement. That news gets back to China on May 4th, 1919. It touches off massive demonstrations in Tiananmen Square, was sort of the political locus of China. And that then kicks off this, what is known as the May 4th movement in China, which was a movement away from American liberal ideas as a potential model for China, and a movement much more towards Soviet ideas of a violent revolution, a Bolshevik type government, basically focusing on Western imperialism as the source of all of China's problems and not the Manchu dynasty as the source of China's problems. And basically they'd found a new enemy, and that enemy had become us.
Yeah, although then interestingly, in the decade before and even for a couple of decades after, American ideas and education and cultural influences very much had an impact in China.
Yeah, the May 4th movement really wasn't sort of the end, but it was sort of a beginning of the tipping point towards Russia. But Americans were still very deeply involved in, specifically through the Boxer Indemnity Scholarships, in educating the Chinese.
So just very quickly, the Boxer Indemnity Scholarships.
So the Boxer, basically, there was a Boxer Rebellion in 1900 where the Qing Dynasty, Cixi, the Empress Dowager, basically encouraged a group of kung fu fighters, if you will, but tens of thousands of these guys, to rebel against the foreigners with this idea that this peasant rebellion, a peasant-based rebellion, would be able to roust the foreigners out from northern China. It didn't work. Eight armies from eight Western powers, including the United States, Russia, the Germans, and Japan, Britain, suppressed the rebellion and then charged China about $300+ million in gold as an indemnity. And several years later, I mean, the Americans had actually been one of the countries that, one, blocked China's dismemberment, again, because of this American idea that China needed to be whole. And two, they tried to keep the Boxer Indemnity, the sort of the fine, if you will, as low as possible. But then several years later, in the early 1900s, the Americans proposed to the Chinese that they return half the indemnity that the Americans had collected from China and invest that money into Chinese scholarship. So giving Chinese, one, in building universities, they built Tsinghua University in China, but two, in bringing Chinese to the United States to study. But the Boxer Indemnity was not the sole thing that Americans did to educate the Chinese. Missionary organizations were also bringing hundreds of Chinese to the United States. And now, of course, the United States, there's 250,000 Chinese in American universities and high schools. At the time, the Chinese were actually also a very prominent fixture in any major American university campus around the country. even more than the Canadians in terms of the foreign student population. While many more Chinese actually studied in Japan, the number of Chinese who took PhDs in the United States versus those who took advanced degrees in Japan is like, it's greater by a factor of about 8. Same with Europe. And the Chinese who were educated in America came back to China as moderates because the scholarships gave them enough money so they could focus on actually studying. Whereas in Japan and in Europe, the scholarships were paltry and the Chinese were poor and they were forced to do a lot of labor in order to eat. And that had a tendency to hook them up with labor unions, naturally. And they came back to China much more radicalized than if they'd been educated in the United States, where it wasn't a cushy life by any way, shape, or form, but they had enough resources and were given enough support so they actually could focus on their study. And so when they returned to China in the 20s and the 30s, these American educated Chinese lay the foundation for all of the major fields in China: biology, paleontology, geology, history, even literature. A variety of these fields were found: nursing, medicine, medical science, scientific research, were founded by American educated Chinese who were sort of the creme de la creme of the society. And they became sort of the moral voice of the country. And that lasted up until 1949.
And we're talking about like 30,000 people who studied under the Boxer and Dunwoody scholarships.
And missionary scholarships. I mean, it's 30,000, 50,000. It's in terms of the percentage of China's population, it's not that big. They really boxed above their weight, no pun intended, in terms of their influence in China as well. And many Chinese looked to them as the conscience of the country for decades.
Another person, a specific person who influenced thought in China and encouraged Chinese to think critically and scientifically was the philosopher and educator John Dewey. So he lectured all over China for a couple of years. He'd gone just for a short trip but decided to stay. And Chinese just ate it up, what he had to say. This was really interesting stuff to think logically and critically, you know, be bold in your hypothesis, but then really, really bear down and figure out whether you can prove it with facts.
Yeah, so the pragmatic American philosophy of Dewey really touched a chord among the Chinese who were dealing with a lot of problems in their society. They felt that China was the sick man of Asia, had lots of problems on the economic front, on the political front, and Dewey offered them tools that they could use to begin to unpack some of the problems. And he was very interested in pragmatic solutions, not in revolutions, but sort of in retail approach to China's issues. That touched a very deep chord, even among people like Mao, another communist, and other radicals. Ultimately, Mao rejected that, and many other Chinese rejected the whole Dewey sort of go-slow approach for a much more radical, convulsive, violent approach that was offered by the Bolsheviks. But for many years, even after May 4th, he was in China from 1919 to 1921, he was extraordinarily influential, and his influence continues today. I mean, the whole kind of Deng Xiaoping idea of seeking truth from facts is pulled right out of the Dewey playbook, and the much more pragmatic Chinese economic policies of the 1980s, 90s, even up until today, have a real Dewey-esque feel to them. They also imply a total rejection of the Maoist economic principles, which were much more radical and convulsive. And if you look at the road that China has taken over the last 30 or 40 years, it's clear that Dewey's influence in China remains today.
So Mao was, at least at one time, open to Western philosophy, Western ideas, a Western approach to critical thinking. What did he think of America early on?
Well, Mao was always obsessed with the United States, but he always seemed to be getting America wrong. And so in the 1920s, when the United States was going through, actually the 1910s, when America was going through its Red Scare, and there were a lot of anarchist bombings in the United States, not a lot, but enough to scare people, he thought, oh, this is the beginning of a great revolution, that the American people are going to rise up against the capitalist system. He had these same kind of illusions or delusions that America was going to flip in the 1950s, in the 1960s. He was very interested in radical black politics in America. He viewed African-American radicals as the vanguard of a revolution that was coming to the United States. It never came. He looked at the United States as the apex of Western civilization and the apex of capitalist development. He believed that when the great communist revolution was going to come, it was going to come in America first because it was the most advanced country. he was also a complete nut for American movies. And so when the Dixie Mission was coming into Yan'an, which was the communist headquarters during the Second World War, they would always bring him movies and American whiskey, and he watched basically every movie with a translator right by his side.
Did he have favorites?
He liked the kissy movies and he liked the action movies. As long as it was a Hollywood film, he wanted to watch it.
Huh.
He was a big fan of dancing and dancing to American music, because jazz, American jazz in China was very, very big, starting in the 1910s and going up through the 1940s. And some of that rubbed off on him as well. He also was a big fan of English. He studied English almost every day in the morning for most of his life. And he could read it pretty well. And that was a self-taught. I mean, you know, Mao, there's a certain Confucian element to Mao Zedong. He was interested in self-improvement. And English was the language he chose to learn, not Russian.
Huh. It seems like there are a number of, you know, kind of could-have-beens in the China-U.S. relationship. Certainly one of them was Sun Yat-sen, yet again in the early 20s, going to the U.S. and saying, just support us and, you know, we'll move forward and we'll be your ally. And he was again sort of dismissed and then turned to the Soviet Union. There's Mao, and certainly there has been an argument made that at one point there might have been the possibility of having a different kind of relationship between Mao's China and the United States. Do you think that's credible? Do you think that there really could have been a different kind of China-U.S. relationship under Mao?
You know, that's a great question, and I don't think so. So in 1945, the communists, Mao, through the Dixie Mission, make a request to the U.S. government to allow Mao and Zhou Enlai to go to America to discuss a new alliance with the communists against the Japanese. And historians have looked at that and have looked at some of the things that had happened after that and said this was a great and a huge lost opportunity for the United States. This is something that Barbara Tuchman, who was the author of Stillwell and the American Experience in China, argued as well in the early 1970s, that America had this great lost chance in China. And I think that subsequent research in the Soviet archives and research into the communication between Mao and Stalin clearly show that Mao played the Americans as part of a policy worked out with Stalin to try to neutralize, that's the word that they use, to neutralize the United States and to weaken the possibility of more American direct support for Chiang Kai-shek in what everyone knew would be a looming civil war. And they played the Americans by suggesting to the United States that China was going to be independent from the Soviets. But all the while, the Chinese Communist Party was totally reliant on Soviet gold and weaponry. They played the Americans by suggesting that Mao didn't like the Soviets and that Mao would conduct both an economic policy in terms of openness to Western investment and a foreign policy in terms of being equidistant between Moscow and Washington. And I think that many of the Americans wanted to believe that, partially because they hated Chiang Kai-shek so much that they bought into this idea. But the archives from the KGB, work done by Soviet and Russian historians, and work done by Chinese historians as well, including Chen Jian from Cornell, have really drawn into question that kind of chestnut of belief.
So the U.S. and China were allies during World War II. It was the U.S. and Chiang Kai-shek's China, Republic of China. Why did they hate him so much?
I think that Chiang Kai-shek has, for many decades, has been treated unfairly. That's changed over the last 10 years or so as, one, his diaries have been opened to researchers, and we get an understanding of what he was going through and the pressures that he had to face as the leader of his country. But the general idea was that Chiang Kai-shek was given everything he needed to fight the Japanese, but he didn't fight. He basically hoarded his weaponry and mismanaged the economy and was totally corrupt and deserved his fate. And that's sort of the general kind of idea that the many State Department officials kind of embraced.
There were nicknames for him.
They called him Cash My Check, one nickname. And then, of course, General Joe Vinegar Joe Stillwell, who was the commander of American forces in China, called him Peanut. He believed his head looked like a peanut. And it's okay. Just a sort of racist crap. But I think that in the light of archival research by historians and others, the new portrait of Chiang Kai-shek is, I think, and the portrait in my book, I think is a little bit more even-handed. He was faced with enormous, one, this guy's not in total control of whatever little country he's running. He has to deal with a variety of warlords whose loyalty to him is questionable. Half of his country has been hived off by a communist party, which is not fighting the Japanese, much as people claim that they were. And his troops are taking huge casualties against the Japanese. And so the argument that the KMT or the Nationalist Army didn't fight is just not borne out by the facts. I mean, 90% of the casualties on the Chinese side were inflicted by the Japanese on the Nationalist troops, right? The communists had about 10% max. And if you look at where the Japanese are hitting, Chongqing was subject to withering airstrikes for years, whereas Yan'an, the headquarters of the communists, was hit maybe 3 or 4 times, maximum 6 times over the course of the year. So it's clear that the Japanese were putting their firepower of trying to unseat the government. So to say he didn't really try, I think just defies logic.
And so partly because of the dislike of Chiang Kai-shek, there were mixed feelings in the United States when Mao came to power. Or at least certainly in the lead up to Mao coming to power and the Communist Party coming to power, there wasn't the resistance that you might, sitting here in the present, think that there might have been back then.
Right. I mean, because of the basically hatred and lack of respect of Chiang Kai-shek, which was founded on this idea that he didn't fight and all of his guys were corrupt. There, you know, truth be told, there was significant corruption within the KMT. But because of this, on the flip side, there was a romanticization of the communists as kind of the David versus the Japanese Goliath, as the guerrilla fighters. They were kind of like, you know, the Minutemen with Chinese characteristics battling the Japanese. And so when the revolution happens among a significant percentage of the American population, there's no sense of that's a bad thing. Now, there was this belief that we lost China, but a significant percentage of the American population basically said, well, it's because the good guys won. And so in the interim between kind of 48, 49, up until before June of 1950, you look at U.S. policy trying to figure out, is there a moment where we can pull Chairman Mao away from the Russians? And the Chinese, the communists, encouraged the Americans to think this way, again, because their overriding goal was to ensure that the United States did not get directly involved in the Civil War.
So this triangular relationship, the relationship between China and the Soviet Union, and then the Soviet Union and the U.S.,
right,
the U.S. and China, that became very important from the moment the People's Republic of China was created onward.
Right. But it became a critical element starting in June of 1950, actually, when, with Soviet backing, the North Koreans invaded South Korea. And that's the moment where Taiwan then became sort of a political football, and the Seventh Fleet interposed itself between mainland China and Taiwan on the Taiwan Strait, and then the U.S. engaged itself in a war first with the North Koreans, and then, of course, with the Chinese People's Liberation Army. They weren't called that. They were called the Chinese People's Volunteers, but it was the PLA.
So that was in the 50s, and then how did the relationship play out going forward?
So while most people in academia, they looked at the Sino-Soviets as there being no daylight between Mao and Stalin, or then ultimately Mao and Khrushchev. But if you look at U.S. policy, there was a lot more sense that perhaps we could force daylight between Mao and the Russians. American policy towards China in the 1950s was much harsher than it was towards the Russians. So our economic embargo was all-encompassing against China, whereas subsidiaries of American companies could do business with the Soviet Union. No Americans were allowed to travel to China, whereas Americans could travel to the Soviet Union. So there was a sense, perhaps, that a wedge could be forced between the two of them. And when Khrushchev embraces Eisenhower's ideas of peaceful coexistence, you see Mao being very upset with this. And in 1959, directly after meeting with Eisenhower at Camp David, Khrushchev goes to Beijing and tells Mao that, well, now that I'm working on peaceful coexistence with the United States, I have to stop supporting your atomic bomb program. And in addition, by the way, the Americans have asked me to instruct you to release 5 Americans, which you've been holding in custody since the early 1950s. Would you do that? At which point Mao was livid. one of his marshals, Chen Yi, almost got into a fist fight with Khrushchev. And from then on, the relationship just goes between the two sides, the Russians and the Chinese, goes into a tailspin. Now, it wasn't like the Americans sparked the Sino-Soviet split, but we had a role to play.
Yeah, and then in the early 70s, Nixon thinks, aha, I can play this game a different way.
Right. So 10 years later, the Americans then pivot, and they pivot away from the Russians and toward the Chinese and use the relationship with China as a way to bedevil and ultimately to take down the Soviet Union. It's probably the example that disproves the rule that the United States and China are always destined to disappoint each other. Because in this case, the Americans and the Chinese were effectively quasi-allies and worked not just for 5 years, but for 17 years, from the early 70s to 1989, ultimately to dismantle the Soviet Union.
So this is on the level of statecraft and diplomacy. On the personal level, so you're a Chinese person, you've grown up, let's say, in the 1920s and 30s, and you've been watching American films, and you've been hearing American music, and you've got these people you look up to who studied in the United States, and then the Communist Party comes into power, and suddenly there's all of this demonizing of America, you know, vicious anti-American propaganda, and then another 30 years go by, and suddenly it's reform and opening up, and Deng Xiaoping is wearing a Texas cowboy hat, and, you know, we're all friends again.
So in the early 1950s, we have Zhou Enlai complaining to the Russian ambassador, Pavel Yudin, that this is like in the very early 50s when they're trying to take over the cities. You know, they've taken over the country, but they don't have their ducks in a row, saying that the most difficult thing we're facing in the cities is to get people to hate the United States, is this pro-American feeling of many Chinese people. I mean, in Beijing at the time, in the late 40s, in the Chinese expression, ban shi means to do something, like, you know, I have some things to do. But they would say ban mei shi, which means to do things the beautiful way or the American way. It was part of the vernacular that the United States just did things, and Americans just did things the right way. And removing that idea had the complexity of amputating a limb in many cases. So in Shanghai in the early 50s, when the whole country is launched on this huge campaign against the United States as the Chinese are fighting American forces on the Korean Peninsula, Chen Yi, who is the mayor at the time of Shanghai, China's most important city, basically writes up to Beijing and says, you cannot force me to stop people watching American movies, because if you do that, I'm going to have riots, because people were so in love with Hollywood films. And so Shanghai got a special dispensation to allow the American films to be screened up until like 1955 or so, whereas the rest of the country was the cinemas, when it came to American movies, were dark. These whiplashes between what to think about the United States have gone on for time immemorial. I mean, this is not simply a 1949 thing. This also happened in the 1860s as well. The Chinese have never really figured out how much of the United States is enough. And so even up until today, right, you have this incredible love for American Breaking Bad. All these, you know, American cultural exports have a huge market in China, in addition to, you know, American values, American education, the student-athlete ideas of our education system are also very attractive to the Chinese, and they will remain so. And also the United States, of course, has a destination for Chinese immigrants, again, starting in the 19th century, and it hasn't ended until today.
What about American attitudes toward China, particularly over the last half century or so? So, you know, I was a kid in the 60s and 70s, and I remember the really vitriolic propaganda, if you want to use that word, was against the Soviet Union. I don't remember there being a huge amount against China. China was sort of this black hole where there was also a communist government, but it wasn't like feel antagonistic toward China.
Right. So in the 50s, there was a lot more anti-Chinese propaganda in the United States, specifically around the idea of brainwashing. Basically, it's sort of Fu Manchu meets Chairman Mao. And this combination of Chinese wiles, and that the Chinese were going to be able to manipulate your mind and take you over that way. And that was China's new weapon of mass destruction. And the Chinese encouraged that because, of course, they like people to be afraid of them. They believe that that's important. The capstone of that idea was the great movie, The Manchurian Candidate, where Wen Lo, who's his Chinese puppet master, brainwashes an American plant who comes back to assassinate a presidential candidate, which will end up with the takeover of America by pro-Chinese agents. So that was a big thing in the 50s. In the 60s, the anti-China stuff sort of mellows in a way. But then there's also some other parts of the society become very pro-Chinese. So the idea of China on the campuses in American universities among radical student unions was enormously attractive. I remember being a 9-year-old kid in 1968 around Columbia, and the students are chanting right around, because I grew up on the Upper West Side of New York, Mao, Mao, Chairman Mao, and the Students for Democratic Society, well organized along Maoist principles. Chairman Mao's ideas that women hold up half the sky were actually foundational to the kick in the growth of the U.S. feminist movement in America. So at one side, on sort of an official culture, there's less anti-Chinese propaganda in the 60s. But in terms of student culture and young people's culture, there's just a lot of respect and fascination with what's going on in China. And that was encouraged in many ways by academics who were generally of a progressive or leftist bent and who thought, for example, the Cultural Revolution was an amazing thing. It was a place where actually people are, you know, breaking down structures and creating a new society. And that played into a lot of the ideas of what students were doing on campuses in the United States.
Yeah, you were in China at a university in the early 80s, and you were talking to your friends there and hearing what their experience had actually been like during the Cultural Revolution.
Right. So then, of course, like with many of these American reveries and fantasies about China, it turns out not to have been true. So the Cultural Revolution was actually a pretty horrible time. 600,000 plus, maybe 2 million people were murdered or committed suicide. It was as a result of basically a crackdown on every well-educated person that the Red Cards could find. So a lot of American-educated Chinese did very badly during the anti-rightist campaign in 1955, where hundreds of thousands of people were sent to labor camps to starve or just die of overwork. And then 10 years later, another wave of this anti-Western, anti-education insanity happened in China. And the American-educated people who had slipped through the cracks of the earlier campaign got it in the teeth again. And so we have situations where this Cultural Revolution went on from 1966 to 1976. In the middle, we have the Nixon opening to China, at which point American scientists begin to come to China. And some of them had done work with Chinese scientists before 1949. And so you have these very touching stories of these American scientists coming to China. And they were sort of a leftist bent. And they would meet their old Chinese partners. And they would write glowing reports about them in Scientific American and other American publications about, oh, I went to see, you know, in one case, this plant biologist named Liu Shuwei. I went to see Liu Shuwei in Shanghai, and he's doing great. And he really believes in having science for the people. And isn't that wonderful? And they would write these long, glowing reports in American publications. And then we learned a few years later, of course, in the 1980s and after, that actually Liu Shuwei had at the time been living in a hut in rural Jiangsu province and had been criticized for many, many years in a row, had been beaten on a regular basis, and had been basically trotted out to meet these American scientists as part of a communist operation to convince the Americans that everything was okay in China. But actually, he was actually put back in the apartment that the Chinese had stolen from him. And then once the Americans left China, he was sent back to the countryside to continue living in his hut. And these and many other stories were stories that I learned in China in the 1980s, when my classmates basically said, you know, we heard you Americans thought the Cultural Revolution was a great thing. Well, let me tell you what happened to me.
Yeah. And you write about that in a very affecting way in Chinese Lessons, which I recommend to anyone who's listening. You were also in China in 89. You were in the square, in Tiananmen Square, where, speaking of attitudes toward America, there was a replica of the Statue of Liberty.
Right. So actually, it's sort of funny. There's a whole debate, an academic debate, about how much was the goddess of democracy, which was that iconic structure that was put in the middle of Tiananmen Square near the end of the protest, how much it was taken from the Statue of Liberty. But the reality was, it was very much inspired by the Statue of Liberty. And many of the ideas, sort of foundational ideas of the United States, separation of powers, democracy, one man, one vote, open press, were ideas that students and the student leaders at the time embraced. They had, of course, their other motivations. Inflation was high. They felt that there weren't many opportunities for people like them in a system that they believed was rigged, et cetera, that prompted them to march. But America was a really important idea to them. And I think in many cases, it remains an important idea as well to many people in China. But the Tiananmen Square crackdown, of course, sort of ended that. And for many Americans, it ended the idea, for the time being at least, that China was going to be ready to follow in America's footsteps.
How much do you think there's still interest among Chinese in China one day becoming a democracy?
Well, I think that a couple things have happened. One is that the Communist Party has been very good about convincing Chinese that China is a victim. And the whole victim ideology has been something that's really been pushed since 1989 through something called the Patriotic Education Campaign. And the idea that the Americans and the Japanese are out to contain China, and that our system, democratic system, is a system that, if it was transformed to China, is a system that would make China weak. And they look at countries around the world and they say, well, if we copy democracy, actually, we're not going to end up like America, they've been told. We're actually going to end up potentially like the Russians or like the Indians. And that's not the road that we want to take. Those countries aren't as powerful as we want to be. And I think the government's been successful in convincing the people that that would be China's fate if it embraced democracy. I also think that the rapid growth in property ownership in China makes people, at least for the time being, a lot more conservative, because people just don't want to lose what they have. In 1989, nobody had anything. There was no ownership of property in any of the cities. And now in China, if you look across the cities, most people are landowners. I mean, they own their apartment. And so they have a significant amount of skin in the game, and that is a stabilizing influence. And so of the small percentage of the Chinese who kind of want a different political system, I think a significant part of that percentage wants a political system that they will obtain through evolution and not through revolution. In addition to these other things that the Chinese Communist Party has convinced its people of, it's also convinced its people that many other people in China, the riffraff, if you will, don't have the values that would let a revolution turn into a positive light, and that China would actually could be forced into a significant period of what they call chaos if a real revolution happened. And so I think there's a certain amount of patience that with economic development, we are going to be able to change the system, but it's going to take a lot of time. And I think that the more liberal parts of the party have been very successful at convincing many Chinese that that's the right road to take.
So here in the United States, we're in transition. We've had an election. We'll have a new president next month. We're speaking in mid-December 2016. If President-elect Trump were to give you 2 minutes and to say, okay, what do I need to know about China? What does the history of U.S.-China relations have to tell me that would be useful in my presidency? What would you say?
So in the book, I argue for a much more transactional view of U.S.-China relations, that America needs to understand first what it wants from China and then go get it. And that United States' mistakes in the past have been because of our sense of sort of a rapturous enchantment with China, or the sense that China was going to ultimately become more like us, that we were willing to give more to China than we should have given and not gotten as much from China that we should have gotten. The belief that the relationship needed to be positive for the relationship's sake, not necessarily for the sake of the United States, because of this belief that if the Chinese could be convinced to like us, they would turn their economy into a more liberal market direction and their political system into a more open direction. And I think that that's been a mistake. So I argued for more transactional. It's like, we need this. We need you to do this. You have to do it. And okay, what do you need us to do? That said, with Trump in power, he is by nature someone who does deal with others on a transactional basis. He's a businessman. He wants to make a deal. And so I worry that he might go too much in that direction the other way, and basically put everything up on the auction block with the Chinese.
And specifically, you've talked about Taiwan.
Specifically Taiwan, because basically there's two strains in U.S. looking at China, if you will, greater China. One is strong and stable, and it's something that we've backed as a policy from the 1840s on, and we have that in mainland China. And the other is an Americanized China, and we have that in Taiwan now, which is arguably the most democratic country in Asia, freest press in Asia, which is really a bastion of both Chinese values. Actually, even Chinese from the mainland look at Taiwan and think that that's where traditional Chinese values exist. So it's a bastion of Chinese values, but also democratic values. And so our policy basically to engage with both of these entities is part of our DNA in dealing with China. And I worry that if Trump puts Taiwan on the auction block, is saying, hey, okay, you got to help me with North Korea, in which case I'm going to back off on Taiwan and maybe even force him to negotiate a political settlement with you or whatever, then I really worry that he's taken transactional ideas too far.
And how do you think Xi Jinping sees the relationship now, the president of China and the head of the Communist Party? You know, it's been complicated, and he's certainly been more aggressive in pushing for China's interests vis-a-vis the United States than his previous two predecessors. Is your perception that he and other top leaders in the Communist Party think that it's inevitable that China will rise and the U.S. will fall? Or, in fact, are they feeling a little bit insecure and not really entirely sure whether China will rise, and so they have to push for advantage now while they can?
I think it's the latter. I think that there's a lot of paranoia and a lot of concern. In America, we have a tendency to overestimate China and underestimate their problems. If you look at what China's facing right now, they're facing a slowing economy, even though they can juice it with investment, but it's still slowing. They're facing a really bad demographic picture. They still have real difficulties with their environment. They're surrounded by neighbors who don't really like them very much. And, you know, look at us. I mean, we have Canada and Mexico. And as long as we don't alienate them, we're doing okay. And then we have two big oceans. And in the competition with the United States, and they definitely view this as a competition, they worry about American power on a regular basis. But also at the end of the day, Xi Jinping's main concerns are domestic. And foreign policy to him is a function of domestic policy. It's always been for the communists. And the relationship with the United States is important to his domestic constituencies because he needs stability with us still. I mean, foreign trade is for China only 21% of its economy, and that's shrunk significantly. But it's still a big chunk, and America is a large chunk of that foreign trade. And so he needs predictability and stability from the United States. And he looks at Donald Trump and he sees an unpredictable partner who could cause significant instability in the relationship. And I don't really think he wants that. Interestingly enough, the Chinese kind of were rooting for Trump, figuring that as a pragmatic businessman, it would be, let's make a deal. But now they're actually quite worried about him, I think. And if you read Chinese newspapers, they're all over the map in terms of how they're analyzing him right now.
Yeah, and just within the last few days from when we're talking here, Trump said, one China policy, why should I have to follow that? I mean, the fact that it's been around for, you know, 30, 40 years, that doesn't mean I have to be bound to it. And there was a lot of alarm in the China watching community, at least in certain quarters of it. How do you feel about Trump having made that statement? And to what extent do you think it actually risks outright military conflict with China?
So I am sympathetic both to people who say you're rocking the ship on one on China. It's the basis of the relationship. It's kept the peace for 40 years, right? I'm very sympathetic to that view. But I'm also sympathetic to the other view, which is Taiwan's a democracy. And they have made amazing strides. And what can we do to support that democracy? Because at the end of the day, it's actually a Chinese community, whether they think they're part of China or not, but it's a Chinese community that's democratic. And it's basically everything that America's dreamed for China, a part of America at least, since the 19th century. Freedom of religion, run by a directly elected president, not part of a political dynasty. I mean, what more could you ask for? The issue I have is back to the transactional part. If he's throwing the one China policy into question because he wants to make a deal with China over, for example, North Korea or trade or something else, I just worry that at the end of the day, we're going to throw them under the bus again, because we already did that in 1979. But it was easier to do that then because they weren't a democracy. They were a tight little island run by an authoritarian. But now they're not. And so I worry that changing this situation which arguably none of the sides are very happy with, is actually not going to get us into a better place, but it's going to get us into a worse place.
So over the last 20 years, for sure, there's increasingly been this strain of thought in the United States that the U.S. and China are interdependent. We have many different levels of ways in which we benefit from having a peaceful and productive relationship with each other, while recognizing that predictions are hard, especially about the future. Do you see that still being the case going forward? Or do you see that there could be some disruption to that presumption, that that is the way that we need to deal with each other?
I think there needs to be a hard conversation between the United States and China over the future of the relationship. I think that the Americans believe, and I think in many cases rightly so, that they have done a lot to bring China into the international community to actually help China maximize its national power, as the Chinese say, without getting stuff that we needed from the Chinese. The Chinese are playing fast and loose with American companies in China. If you look in terms of international security in North Korea, the Chinese have not done very much to deal with the North Korean nuclear problem. If you look at issues of international property rights, the Chinese are continuing to violate. On cyber, in terms of using cyber espionage as part of their industrial policy, they do that as well. In Syria, for example, they're in bed with the Russians. Even in counterterrorism, the Chinese cooperation is not what it should be, nor is it in law enforcement. Although that information mostly is not released to the general public, it's the case. And there's a lot of joint cases that both sides need to work on that are not being done. So on a broad front, the United States feels, at the working level, in many areas, hard done by. And that situation has gotten worse over the course of the Obama administration, but it's not something that just started with Obama. It's this long, slow slide in official Washington's view of China. And that slide has been accompanied by increasing alienation in many parts of the business community with China. I think that's drawn into question this idea that the status quo needs to be continued, which is one of the reasons why Trump throwing this one China policy spanner into the works has gotten from many quarters, not just the alt-right quarters, but for many quarters in the United States, somewhat of a positive hearing. Because people who have turned around and said, you cannot change the basis of the relationship because the relationship is just so important, the counter-argument is like, well, what are we getting from the relationship? And I think that there is a discussion to be had that is very important between the two sides that has to go into, like, exactly what are the Chinese doing for us?
But if the Chinese are always going to look after their national interests and we're always going to look after ours, then does it just become a sort of an uneasy detente or an uneasy, you know, relationship where you have sort of mutual suspicion and you look for whatever dirty tricks the other side is playing, but you make your profits and you do your deals where you can?
Well, I think that that might actually be sort of a new realism, a potential paradigm for U.S.-China relations going forward, because the dreamy Gauzy view, influenced by rapturous enchantment, has gotten us to this point. And it's not a good place to be in for either side. Specifically on the North Korean issue, I think that is going to be probably the biggest problem we're going to see in Northeast Asia and perhaps in the world in the coming 5 years. And how the two sides figure out a way to deal with this, for lack of a better word, menace, is going to be critical to the foundation of U.S.-China relations going forward.
But do you think the Chinese government really has the leverage to change the government in North Korea or make the government do what the Chinese government wants it to do? I thought its efforts in the past have been not entirely successful.
Well, start with sanctions. There's a livelihood loophole in the U.N. sanctions regime that allows the Chinese to drive lots of trucks through. Oil exports to North Korea are not even on the sanctions. There's a lot of areas where the Chinese can do more. The issue is, what do the Chinese want? And they want something different on the peninsula than the United States does. And how to square that circle is an important conversation the two sides need to have. Because the continuation of the status quo in North Korea means that within several years, Kim Jong-un is going to have a nuclear warhead that he's going to be able to put onto an ICBM. Right? He's going to have that. It's counter to the national interest of the United States. And we've had a series of secretaries of defense who've said that. And when you say something like that, it's not a joke. And so if the two sides don't figure out what they're going to do together, then the United States is probably going to be forced to act alone. And that could be worse.
It could be worse because China would see it as an act of war against China.
China could see it as an act of war. China's still a treaty ally, you know, or it could precipitate the collapse of the North Korean regime. There's all sorts of potential problems here, right? Not to mention tens of thousands of casualties, civilian casualties in Seoul. The downside of not working together is so ugly that the two sides basically have to work together on this despite their understood lack of mutual trust. But if they can't work together, the United States is clearly going to be forced to act alone. And no matter who won in November, Clinton or Trump, they would be dealing with this issue. This, from my perspective, is the lever that we need to use to wake the Chinese up, to understand that we're not simply the facilitator of China's rise, because that's the role we've played for four decades. We're also a country that has core interests as well, and the Chinese must respect them in addition to us respecting theirs.
Yeah. One last question, I think, and that is, in terms of the long-term China-U.S. relationship, there are many variables, there are many plausible futures. Can you see a plausible future whereby the Chinese government is more like us?
Long-term, in terms of the future of China, I'm generally optimistic, actually. I think that there's lots of Chinese who want to live a freer life, and their lives are already significantly freer than they used to be. Chinese people, the young kids, now much more so than their parents, of course, are agents of their own fate. You know, they graduate from college and they're not assigned a job. They go into the workforce, they compete. It's a highly competitive society. It's also a very entrepreneurial society. So I think that long term, that desire to have a better life is going to bleed over naturally into a desire to have more freedom. And as personal freedom expands, people will want to have more political freedom and more predictability. So a court system that is not run by the party. Ultimately, I'm relatively optimistic. I just think that the time frame that many Americans had that this was going to happen overnight or just in the space of a couple of decades is been misunderstood, partially because Americans had a tendency to conflate very powerful pro-American proclivities of the Chinese with the Communist Party of China, which represents a very different strain of how to look at the West. So just like I said, we're, you know, somewhat schizophrenic in our views of China. Of course, on the other side, they're very schizophrenic in their views of us. Part of their society is very open to Western ideas, incredibly open, incredibly adaptive to Western ideas. Another part is also very rigidly against the West. And this is very xenophobic. And this is not just the communists. This has gone back to Confucian China as well. And so they have to deal with these demons just like we have to deal with our own demons on the Chinese.
John Pomfret, thanks for joining me on Whose Century Is It?
Great. Thanks for having me.
So here's the thing about those demons. Even in the eras when one side tried to shut the other out, the Chinese Exclusion Act in late 19th century America, Mao Zedong's reign in the 1950s and 60s in China, the relationship was always too complex and multi-layered and, well, emotional for it to be cut clean. I mean, think about it. Even if you prune a tree almost back to its trunk, eventually, new branches and leaves have a way of bursting forth. We may be entering a season of severe pruning. Or, as has happened with more than one U.S. president who talked tough about China when first taking office, Donald Trump may become more pragmatic as he goes along. America's standing as a respected global leader may depend on it. And if he doesn't, China is now positioned for the first time in the history of the U.S.-China relationship to offer more leadership than the United States on issues like combating climate change. Might not have seen that coming just a decade ago. And a decade from now, or a century from now, how will we look back on this chapter that's about to start in the U.S.-China relationship and its impact on the world? Wouldn't we all like to know? I'm guessing that whatever the Trump administration does to try to make America great again, as it sees it, the rest of the world will go on and become more multipolar, with more countries and more alliances with each other, and less dependent on the United States. I'm also guessing that whatever else happens, the U.S.-China relationship will continue to be one of the most important in shaping the century, and we can only hope that in the long throw of things, it shapes it for the better. My thanks to John Pomfret for sitting down with me for this episode, and for the 6 years he's put into writing this exceptional book. It's worth reading. So is his earlier book, Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of the New China. You can find more about this episode and all our other episodes at pri.org/century. You can also find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just look up Whose Century Is It and hit subscribe. And if you like the podcast, please rate us and leave a review. It helps others find it. And that leaves me to say that Whose Century Is It is a co-production between me and PRI's The World in cooperation with the BBC World Service and WGBH. It's funded by a grant from the Henry Luce Foundation. Back soon with another episode about the brave new world we're entering and how we got here. Come on back and listen in.